Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy, and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. My guest today is Air Chief Marshal Sir Andrew Pulford, who served for almost four decades in the Royal Air Force, rising to become Chief of the Air Staff, the professional head of the RAF. Sir Andrew led the services through some of their most complex modern operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria, while also steering it through a period of profound organisational change. A career helicopter pilot, he commanded on the front line and went on to shape the professional development of thousands of men and women, often leading big teams under extreme pressure, balancing immediate operational demands with long-term reform. Today, he remains a respected voice on defence, leadership and the people who serve in our armed forces. Air Chief Marshal Sir Andrew Pulford, welcome to this episode of the Business Leaders Podcast.
Thanks very much, Mike. It all sounds very grand.
It does, but it's very good to see you. Thanks for coming in. So, as I said there, you rose through the ranks from helicopter pilot to Chief of the Air Staff. So what, in your view, defines effective leadership at the very top of an organisation?
Well, of course, to get to the very top, I had to start at the bottom. And my leadership was really, you know, shaped by leading a crew of an aircraft, in my case, helicopters. And then that grew into a flight, a squadron, a station, a group. So by the time I got to the very top, my leadership skills had been developed. They'd been formed out of experience, good and bad, and shaped by not just the military background, but the Ministry of Defence, operating with civil servants, operating with civilians, running a station with families. So by the time I got to the top, the business I was in was pretty diverse, and hopefully my leadership skills were then ready for that challenge. But the principles of leadership had not changed from the very bottom. You know, briefing a crew to go flying on an op or a training mission, to shaping, as you said, the Royal Air Force and leading it through challenging times. Clear intent. What are we about? What are we for? What are we doing?
And that's the top thing.
Absolutely. If people don't know why they're there, then you've got something very wrong. And to me, you know, buying the crewman into we're going to go and do something in the back of a Wessex, and then two of them in the Chinook with your co-pilot, versus getting the Air Force board together and saying, okay, this is what we're going to do with an Air Force. So that clear intent, this is what we're for. And then, of course, achievable goals. You've got to give people things to do that are achievable. If you're offering them something that's overambitious and they can see that, then they're not going to be with you. Achievable goals, and achievable in the sense of having the resources to do it, whether that be money, materials, manpower, they've got to be achievable. And otherwise, your credibility's gone. To be a credible leader at the very top, you've got to either break down your ambition into smaller achievable goals, or you've got to phase it. And you've got to then finally, you know, you've got to have that shared purpose. You've got to buy people in to what you're for, the achievable goals that you set out, and they've got to believe in it. And I think if you've got those three things, then people are with you. You're taking a crew of an aircraft forward. You're taking an Air Force command system. And remember, you know, I was commanding an Air Force with layers of organization, well-defined, defined by rank on shoulders or on sleeves, with an organized structure. And that makes leadership so much easier when much of your authority is coming from the fact that you're already in a position and there's a level of trust that he must know what he's doing, mustn't he?
Okay, so taking that further forward, you spent much of your career, certainly the front end of your career, flying operational missions, Northern Ireland, Falklands, Gulf, Afghanistan. So feeding into what you've just said, how did those experiences shape your approach to leadership?
Well, I was very lucky in the sense that I went into multi-crewed aeroplanes. You know, the Fastjet Air Force, a lot of it was single pilot, still is. Whereas I got the leadership challenges of I remember I arrived on the front line as a 20-year-old because I left straight after A-levels at grammar school, joined the Air Force. And, you know, when your early sort of months of flying, you're being crewed up with a crewman who's probably got 30 years on aeroplanes. He's probably in his 40s, if not his 50s. And he's your first leadership challenge. It was also an environment where you would take the aircraft away and you would go into the field. You'd go to Salisbury Plain or Otterburn, not always in the middle of summer, and you'd live in tents. And you're taking engineers with you who are probably used to, in the fast jet and the multi-engine world, living in hotels. What are we doing here, sir? There's your second leadership challenge. So my leadership skills were demanded quite early on, and getting people to understand why we were doing what we're doing, what the purpose of it was. I also say I was very lucky in that I had a couple of exchange tours during my flying, my true operational flying period. I had 2 years with the Navy, who do things differently. I was, you know, excuse the phrase, but I was an ethnic minority. I was the tame crab in naval terms amongst my naval brethren. We went to sea, we did things differently. An awful lot of criticism of the Royal Air Force, I think that's fair to say. And I found myself defending the Royal Air Force. At other times, what the Air Force was doing was indefensible. And I would side with the Royal Navy and say, yeah, okay, I'll take that back. I also had 2 years on exchange with the Royal Australian Air Force. And again, that's an international difference. And seeing things, from the other side of the world, from the side of an Air Force modelled initially on the Royal Air Force. We fought together, you know, very bravely, very courageously during the Second World War. But an Air Force that saw things differently because of society, the Australian way, the environment. But, you know, in terms of leadership, the challenges were very much the same.
But that's a great variety of experience that you're getting very early in your career. Was that important to you?
I think looking back, it was absolutely vital. I think I was incredibly lucky. Getting those, learning the lessons, as it were, doing things wrong, doing things right. Being self-critical, very important to any leader to debrief yourself. How did that go? And again, the flying environment lends itself to that self-criticism, because at the end of any sortie, you don't just go off and enjoy yourself, come back and say, hey, wasn't that great? Let's go and have a beer. You sit down and you debrief and you get into the habit of self-criticism, criticism of the team, the crew. When you start leading a formation of 2, 4, 8, 16 aeroplanes, you get the crews together and, you know, no prisoners here. You criticize everyone regardless. And that's how things are learned. That's how you avoid mistakes. That's how you avoid accidents. And that's how you improve the totality of it. And as an individual aircraft captain, leader, formation leader, you're honing your skills and you're getting into those good habits that, in my case, you know, did not stop when I stopped flying. I did not stop self-assessing. Whatever the leadership position, whether it was a board meeting, you know, you would search out how did that go. You have your trusted deputies. It could be your execs, could be lower down, could be your personal staff officer. What do you think? How did that go? What could I have done better? Would I have done that differently next time?
Okay, so you ended up. Probably the wrong phrase, but you graduated to commanding the Joint Helicopter Command, and there you were responsible for hundreds of personnel, at the same time responsible for critical operations. So how do you maintain your strategic focus and the human connection in a role of that scale?
Yeah, well, let's be right. I did not command the Joint Helicopter Command. I commanded elements of the Joint Helicopter Command on operations.
Ah, my mistake, sorry.
My two-star command was actually two group, which at the time was the big aircraft group. So all the transport aircraft, all the intelligence and surveillance aircraft. So I took elements, I took all the helicopters to war in 2003, and the two-group command was at a time of great, you know, capital change.
2003, that was?
That was the invasion of Iraq. So I was commanding the Chinook wing at Odeon, and we combined with the Pumas. Then eventually I took the Royal Navy commando helicopters on board, on under command, and also elements of the Army Air Corps as well. So that need to communicate your intent, that intent, going back to that intent, using all your lines of communication, using the level, the layers and levels of command. So your immediate grouping around you, your subordinates at the top end, but ensuring that your level of risk is a big one. Your level, your appetite for what people are doing and why. Ensuring they understand the big three to try and grow that unity of purpose. And I will quote the biggest challenge during that period for me as AOC 2 group was risk and understanding my appetite for risk. We were on ops, the Hercules force is the example I'll use, a force which had traditionally been sort of on pretty tight lines. They did, you know, like an airline, they'd fly from A to B. They were using a tactical aeroplane in a very strategic way. It was very ordered, it was very understood. Suddenly, during the noughties, 2003 onwards, Afghanistan and Iraq, they found themselves being used in a very tactical way, what the aeroplane was designed to do. And that meant landing on desert strips, day, night, landing, going into harm's way. And how I got my level of risk of my aeroplanes and my people from my command office to the cockpit of a Hercules was really interesting. Clearly through the force commander, the station commander at Bryce Norton, going out to see them. And even then I failed. I mean, I had captains landing aircraft in the desert at night where there was no runway. They thought they'd seen the runway, no lights. They thought it was a good thing to land and they trashed the aeroplane.
How do you deal with that?
You understand the circumstances. You don't jump to conclusions. You don't jump down throats and say this is all your fault. You try and understand the position they're in. So you gather evidence. You try and understand why they thought that was a good thing to do. And then you correct their mistake. And I think I lost five Hercules during my time as AOC 2 group. We ended up putting, you know, bombs on the wreckage to remove it from the opposition forces' use. And by the end of it, you know, I'd like to think the Hercules force was a much stronger and a much stronger force and in a better position than they had at the start.
And how do you, obviously, you go into great detail there about very practical things that you have to do, but how do you balance that with the, as I say, right from the start, the human connection that you need to maintain? Because in the end, you were responsible for, as I say, hundreds, thousands of personnel.
Yeah. So you're dependent upon your commanders. You know the good ones, you know the bad ones. There are some that need reinforcement. There are others that need freedom. They need, you know, the delegations to actually go out and do what they do very well. And in a military context, that's the majority. There are some that you take more interest in. You keep a, you know, you ensure you keep an eye on, and you turn up. You try and get out as much as you can.
Face to face.
You know, whether that be, you know, a hangar full of 500 people, or whether that be, you know, the crew of an aeroplane. You go and listen. You go and find out what their pressures are, what's worrying them. You know, I always laugh. I sort of. The pressures on our people. I remember going into the UAE. It was the Air Transport Force C-17s, Hercs, and the biggest gripe was not just Wi-Fi and, you know, broadband, the ability to get. It was the amount of Wi-Fi they were getting. It was actually the bandwidth, because the Australians got much more bandwidth. And they were FaceTiming home.
And this is the United Arab Emirates, so obviously a long way from home.
They were on a bare base. I mean, to be fair, they were out in the desert operating out of a field, but we had the ability to get them Wi-Fi. But they wanted bandwidth so they could FaceTime home, because that's what the Australians were doing.
And you wouldn't have known that if you hadn't gone and spoke to people face to face.
You go and listen, because stuff gets filtered. If you're at the very top, you know, you've got well-intentioned subordinates who are filtering what you need to know for various reasons. And you sometimes decide you're going to go and find out for yourself. And I think, you know, turning up, shared adversity, sure. You know, put the kit on, you know, foot patrol in Helmand with the Royal Air Force Regiment. You know, I look back, what on earth was I doing there? You know, with my SA-80, my rifle, with a backpack on my back, walking through Afghan villages. You know, I was probably a liability to the patrol I was with, but my goodness, in terms of getting the message over as to what AOC 2 group's about, when that gets known around the RAF regiment, that you're willing to do that, there's a level of credibility and respect that is grown from that act. That you try and replicate that. It can be done right across the piece, really.
So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded competitive markets. So if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA to explore the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show. An important part of leadership is planning. So given the amount of military conflict around the world, do you think that we as a society are prepared for all eventualities?
I think since 1989, perhaps, there has been a gradual erosion of the relationship between the civilian society in the UK and the military society. Little twists on the way, of course, you know, the IRA and their attacks, both in the UK, within British forces in Germany, forced the regular British military out of uniform, behind the wire, and add that to the continual decline of the reserve, the civilian military, whether it be Navy, Air Force or Army, it doesn't matter. There's grown the idea that defence and security is done by others on behalf of society. I think that's very dangerous. Defence and security of the UK is for everybody. We all have a role to play. And if you look back through history, you know, there potentially is the need for everybody to you know, listen in and understand that this is a more unpredictable world, a very sort of complicated world that we're living in at the moment. More unpredictable, more dangerous, I think, than anything I've seen in my sort of 50 years of association with the military. And yet we have not yet understood the threat. We are ignoring the fact that you know, Putin could do something very silly. It would start off small. You know, you've seen what's gone on in Ukraine. That was initially a very small invasion of eastern Ukraine, and look at what's going on now and the incredible loss of life. You know, incredibly sad, as we know. NATO is not secure, and NATO itself being challenged by leaders as important as the President of the United States. You're seeing elements of NATO and Europe understanding that threat. Poland is a classic example. They get it. They're very close to that threat. The introduction of Finland into NATO with Sweden, the Finns take this very seriously. From what I can see, you know, we in the UK, we don't really get it. We're of a mind, don't worry, the British military will do that. That's what they do. That's a contract that can't be delivered. That's an undeliverable goal.
So in practical terms, what needs to be done? What should people do? How does society in Britain respond?
They have to be informed, and I think in the first instance, you know, they have to have facts made available to them. You know, it'd be interesting to know how many of the UK public have read the recent Strategic Defence Review, the threats that we face and what this government intends doing about it. And I'd like to see, you know, the enthusiasm you see around the UK for the military cadet organisations. They are wonderful, wonderful organisations. You know, 43,000 air cadets. I was at RAF Syston the other day with their National Air and Space Camp. The Army and the Sea Cadets are in similar good shape. Teaching discipline, leadership, technical skills within those environments, that stops at the end of the cadet experience.
Which is what, 18, 19, 20?
Yeah, you've got adult volunteers. Many of the cadets will go on to become adult volunteers within the youth organisations. Some, of course, will join the British military, the regular British military. But there's still a big gap.
Mm.
You know, and I'm not talking, you know, child warriors and child soldiers, that sort of thing. These are healthy, well understood youth organisations. They're not recruiting sergeants for the military per se. And many of those cadets most don't actually join the military, but they do leave with levels of leadership and discipline and an understanding of how teams work.
But is there a need for a greater resilience among the your average man or woman in the street, or the wider populace?
I think resilience is an interesting word, and it was used in the last review. We're in a poor place in terms of resilience, personal resilience. You know, the individual. We're in a very different place to where we were. Most of that is a good thing. You know, mental health is far better understood than it ever was. And the old days of, you know, man up and all of that, stiff upper lip, have gone. But do you know what? That sort of led to a level of individual resilience. I'll liken it to, give you the Air Force example. During the 80s, average death rate of aircrew was probably about 20 a year. So we lost 20 aircrew a year. And a squadron would you know, lose a pilot. And I lost somebody. It's a personal responsibility, but each flying tour, you know, somebody died. And that builds a sort of level of personal resilience and organisational resilience around death. Thankfully, the death rate of aircrew in the British military is tiny. I think, you know, one last year, and that was a Spitfire. You know, the aircraft are very reliable and the training regimes are well managed. But the individuals have lost the ability to deal with death. And yet death is all around us. And you see, you know, a footballer dies in a road accident in Spain. There are people seeking help to deal with it. Well, great that they're seeking help, but why do they need help in the first place?
Right.
You know, where's that personal resilience? And then broader resilience, and that's societal resilience. How we as a nation deal with a threat, how we ensure that we've got the depth of capability within the British military to endure over time. Because if we do find ourselves, you know, facing serious threat in Europe from, let's say, Russia, how do we deal with that? You know, how are our civilian inter-military structures going to cope with that requirement for resilience?
Right. Is there one thing that needs to change, do you think?
Not one thing. This is
broader than that.
This is a broader challenge. And while the political debate is at the moment, you know, what's the number one, probably due to Mr. Farage over the last few days, it's illegal migrants coming across the channel. Today, I think it's probably, you know, the cost of energy and prices going up. The British public have the freedom to focus on things other than defence at the moment. And until that changes and you get a step change in the level of threat and that broader understanding of the threat, then defence is going to be an inconvenience.
Wow, right. Okay. So within that, you've talked all the way through this interview about the emphasis which the military places on such things as service, courage, integrity. How do you translate those leadership skills within the military into civilian organisations?
I think there's very little difference between the two. I've had 7 years. I retired last year from BAE Systems, a major defence organisation, worked very closely with the Air Board and the board, a corporate board of that organisation. The skill sets I saw focused clearly in a different way in terms of profit and loss, but in terms of delivery of equipment, capability, and the people I work with, their qualities, the levels of leadership, and how that leadership was applied were very little different from that I saw in the military. There's a tendency to think, you know, I'm military, I've got all these amazing leadership skills. The respect for anybody, I mean, it's a word poorly used, I think, and you know, half the time is not used. Respect for people's position, colour, language, sexual orientation, gender. You know, if we had more respect, greater understanding, respect born of understanding, I think we'd be a better society. Integrity, people having the moral courage to stand up for what's right and wrong. You know, people just hide behind. There's the pack mentality. People hide and they join, you know, the football crowd sort of mentality. Think about what you're saying. Think about what you're chanting. Is that right? Do you think that's appropriate? Well, everybody else is doing it. Well, that doesn't mean to say it's right. Have the moral courage to stand up. Service. We're a very selfish country at the moment. I think we're not community driven like we were. I live out in the Vale of Bever, you know, a small village, trying to get people to stand up onto the parish council to represent the people. Very difficult. People are not willing to take responsibility. Oh, somebody else will sort that. So service is you know, long gone, and we've got to resurrect that. We've got to understand that we have a duty, you know, to stand up and represent those who can't stand up for themselves. And the other word is because I really like this, rise. You need an E on the end of RINS, and it's excellence.
Right.
We've had too many years of being satisfied with second best. What's wrong with excellence? What's wrong with striving to the best you can possibly be? And that doesn't matter whether it's in the military or in the civilian world.
Okay.
Strive for excellence.
So there are great parallels. Okay. So with the benefit of hindsight, I don't want to retire you too early, but with the benefit of hindsight, looking back on your career, is there a decision or a leadership moment in which you'd you're laughing already, that you might approach differently? You could see that coming, couldn't you?
Yeah, I think there is. There's one thing. Was I a good leader? I hope I was. And judging on some of the feedback that you go searching for, yes, I think I did okay. I think toxic leadership is something that needs to be understood. It's not talked about very often. And that's when your desire to be the best actually leads you to work against fellows. And, you know, I'm not proud of it, but I had a flight when I was on a Chinook squadron. I wanted it to be the best flight, to the extent that I, you know, was clearly, when I look back, working against my fellow flight commanders and their flights. That's counterproductive. That's toxic leadership. That's actually using your position, you know, and arguably the people around you can, in a counterproductive way, in terms of the overall delivery of what the squadron was about. I would definitely change that. I would go back and look at that and go, you were totally out of order.
Well, wait a minute.
For that period.
How did that end?
It ended with me being promoted out of the flight commander job into the second in command of the squadron.
Right.
However. Which is a bad, you know,
on reflection.
Is a bad thing. I mean, fortunately, you know, I look back and realise what I was doing. It wasn't toxic enough to have been counterproductive to the point of somebody else noticing. But I'm not proud of it. I knew I was doing it. And, you know, on reflection, I would definitely have done it a different way.
Okay, so that might feed into this next question. What advice would you give to young professionals about managing their own failures and their resilience?
Yeah, Well, A, it happens. Nobody is perfect. Take every opportunity to take on responsibility. Understand your own limitations. Certainly look to build a good team around you. You know, autocratic leaders don't work. You know, history tells us that. Understand your own weaknesses.
Although history is showing that there are a considerable number of autocratic leaders around.
And they're not good. They're corrosive, they're destructive, and, you know, they change in their own image, and that's not healthy. So you have to build a good team around you, know the strengths and weaknesses, and not just the people around you, but yourself. Be self-critical. Be self-critical before you start. What am I good at? What am I not? How can I work? Delegate and mentor the people around you. Make sure they understand why you're making the decisions you're making, and look to grow people. And that, of course, will then reflect on you, not for you to then own it, but actually, you know, to represent the team in an appropriate way. Somebody has to sit at the top. Somebody has to guide, direct, deliver that intent. But you do that as a team, and you thank the team, and you ensure that the team are actually appreciated as a team, not just as yourself as the leader.
So, finally, reflecting on your career, what would you like your legacy to be?
Yeah, it's you look back. I was asked that by a retired air marshal before I started. What at the end of my time as chief of the air staff would I want to be remembered for? And I think it was clearly delivery. You're going to command a military force. You want it to deliver. You want to do what is asked. You want it to be shaped, ready for the future. You want it to be, you know, light on its feet, responsive, and able to react, and also, you know, healthy for the longer term. But you also want it to be, you know, any environment, any organisation you're responsible for. You want people to be having fun, okay? Not all the time. There are pretty bad times. You can imagine in my career, there have been some pretty desperate times. But overall, you want people to be enjoying being part of the organisation you're leading. You've got to provide the space for fun. Fun is not a sort of luxury. It's got to be a given. And if you can spend time getting the job done within the resources you're given, building for the future, and the people around you are having fun and are clearly seem to be having fun, you're probably getting it about right.
Goodness, I'd say amen to that. Air Chief Marshal Sir Andrew Pulford, thanks very much for being our guest for this episode of the Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with Sir Andrew Pulford, KCB CBE, why not listen to previous episodes with the former Chief Executive of the Financial Ombudsman Service, Caroline Wyman, the former European Vice President of Toyota, Marvin Cook, OBE, or the President of the RAF Association, Sir Baz North, KCB OBE. This episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast was produced by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.